Hey, Sam Stein here with Huffin' and Post Drinking and Talking. Now, usually on this show, we try to have a lighthearted conversation. The topic that we discuss is political. We have a bunch of people on. They get boozy. We laugh. This time around, it's a bit different. The topic's really serious. It's about police shootings that have happened across this country, setting off protests basically in every major city in the United States. This week, we brought on some people to discuss those protests. With us, we have two very distinguished lawyers here in Washington, D.C., who focus on civil rights law and issues of police brutality. We have Doug Sparks.
Grand jurors are called in to serve, and they do what the prosecutor gives them the lead to do.
And Donald Temple.
You have all these counties, you have these political jurisdictions, and there are thousands of them. And they really are a reflection of the community where they exist.
We also have Jamel Bowie from Slate. He's been writing about this stuff nonstop, a prolific tweeter on the matter as well.
I think it's very clear why that was done. It gives the appearance of a trial having happened, of an adversarial trial having happened, despite that not happening at all.
And we have our own Jason Chirkus, who's been covering it for the Huffington Post.
One thing that I noticed about Wilson's testimony is that he never cops to one thing that I think is sort of a natural thing, is anger.
It's a deep conversation, and it's a long one, but we think the gravity of it all makes it worthwhile, and we hope you enjoy it.
I want to start this off, this gruesome topic that we're talking about. I want to start off with sort of a broad question, which is, at this juncture, what the hell would it take to get a cop to be indicted?
I don't think that it's news that we don't get cops indicted, first of all, as a rule. Seldom happens, but in this particular situation, my heart is heavy, and it's a grave concern that you would have video footage of this nature that is just absolutely clear, and this man dies with the arm around his throat, and these officers on him with that degree of force with on the force continuum with little resistance. It is just chilling, and that black people throughout the country, I got to tell you, have got to be very, very, very concerned. And part of that, too, is the perception of people in terms of how they're viewing black life.
Yeah.
And it's a problem.
I'll say real quick that was it last month or 2 months ago in South Carolina that was that there was that video of the cop driving up to a gas station. There's a dude there outside of his car.
Yeah. That's right.
The cop's like, grab your wallet. And the guy's like, okay. And he reaches to grab his wallet, and the cop's like, put your wallet down, and shoots him a couple times.
Yes.
Which is horrifying if you haven't seen it, because after his shot, the guy's alive. He's like, why did you shoot me?
And he's apologetic.
Right, he's apologetic.
Like, I'm so sorry
he's like,
I'm for sorry. Reaching in my car,
sorry for doing
even though you told
do.
Me to reach in my car.
That cop was indicted. Which is to say, I think the baseline for getting indicted is if you shoot someone on video and there's no, the guy's just standing there, then you get indicted.
So you have to be standing there, not resisting.
You have to be complying. Standing, complying, and then you get shot.
You basically have to be a complete moron. The cop appeared to be. I mean, he seemed
this is the
like,
South Carolina.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the baseline. I think that's the exception.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with Donald.
I think the answer is a lot simpler than that. What it takes to get indicted is a prosecutor who wants to indict somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? That's it. Prosecutor wants to get an indictment, they get the indictment. That's all.
Why do you think that's not the case? I mean, it clearly seems like the prosecution sort of sides with the police, or is it political? Is it they don't want to ruffle feathers? They don't want to just
bring charges? It's an inherent conflict of interest when you have the prosecutors that work day in and day out with the police officers. And then what happens if they indict somebody?
Not only that, they're elected oftentimes, and people who don't understand about the American justice system is that in civil and criminal cases, you have all these counties, you have these political jurisdictions, and there are thousands of them. And they really are a reflection of the community where they exist. There's a big difference between Prince George's County and St. Louis County, for example. And you can go around the country. And so people are not going to harm the constituency that re-elects them.
I'm curious, I want to go back to that point you made, which is you know, the prosecutor has a multitude of different interests, essentially, when he or she says, I'm going to take up this case and I'm going to potentially indict or not indict. They have their own political concerns that they have to think about. They have their own relations with the police officers they have to think about. They have their own relationship with the community they have to think about. You know, in your legal history, I mean, is it more often than not that a prosecutor is going to say, I don't want to stir this pot, I don't want to go for an indictment?
Well, it's not more often than not. I would say it's never.
Never.
The only time I've seen police officer indicted in connection with some kind of a shooting is when it's some rogue officer who is, off duty, shoots his wife in some dispute, or trying to pick up a prostitute off duty, which happened here in D.C., and then ended up shooting the prostitute. And so there's a reason. But in terms of an on-duty police shooting, or really police assault for that matter, I haven't seen any.
Can someone give me an explanation for what purpose the grand jury system actually serves?
I guess one question you can ask is how many black men accused of a crime go to grand juries throughout the country and don't get indicted?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of that, too, you can chime in there, sure, Doug. But, I mean, part of it is the notion that the system is going to be protecting people from crime, and it's easy to get. And this is the irony of Ferguson. It's not difficult to get an indictment.
Yeah. And well, it seemed like they didn't
look. Look, it's originally developed, in theory, supposed to be a guard against the government overreaching and charging people, so you got to present something to a grand jury. In reality, that has nothing to do with our grand jury system. In reality, nothing.
And we got to keep in mind that it's not a trial.
Right.
It's merely a probable cause determination.
Of course.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with that. The reason it is a benefit for prosecutors in many cases these days is because they can use it to bring in witnesses and freeze their testimony that may be beneficial to the one they're tending to indict or whatever. And also they can use it to subpoena and gather information over a long course through the use of grand jury. But it has nothing to do with giving somebody who might get indicted a fair shake. I mean, if they want an indictment, they get an indictment. I don't think that anybody with any experience would dispute that.
Michael Brown, you know, when that process was brought forward, you know, I'm kind of curious if there was anything differently that his family or the legal representatives of the family could have done to affect the outcome.
I
feel free to jump in.
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, just plainly looking at the behavior of McCulloch. Yeah, I always want to say McCulloch, but
yeah.
McCulloch, both during his career as a prosecutor in St. Louis County, and specifically in this case. I mean, I don't think. I think if Michael Brown were a perfect victim, right? Like if Michael Brown were walking down the street, having just purchased, you know, taking his grandma to the grocery store, and was like just being a good guy, and died that way, still no indictment.
I'm just curious as to what from the beginning bothered you—the way Wilson was treated, or I noticed from reading the grand jury testimony that he was allowed to leave the scene on his own, that he took his own gun, that he bagged his gun,
washed his hands
and arms. A lot of the early interviews with him were not recorded.
I can get into all of those, but let's go back to something that precedes even that.
Okay.
Which is, in the minds of the law enforcement officials there, this was never about a homicide investigation. Okay?
Yeah.
Because the definition of a homicide is that what? Somebody kills somebody else, right? It may be justified, it isn't justified. So the victim of the homicide would be the dead person and the suspect would be the one that did it. Mm-hmm. Well, in all of their crime scene reports from the very beginning, they list the victim as the police officer and the suspect as the dead guy.
That's it.
Right? On every one of them, every single one of them.
Wow.
And if you look at, so when they're gathering the DNA, when they're gathering the crime scene evidence, every single thing, St. Louis County Police Department, DNA analysis, everything else, what is it? Well, that's what it is. And what is the offense they're investigating? They're investigating an assault on a law enforcement officer.
Yeah.
So they're never investigating a homicide.
That's
incredible. This is right at the outset. They gather the information. never note the curse, they're investigating a homicide.
So the scales are tilted from the very beginning.
Well, I mean, you tell me. Yeah. You tell me. What do? They take the fingernail clippings off of the dead guy because they're investigating whether he assaulted a police officer. But the guy that killed him, they don't take his fingernail clippings, do they?
They don't touch the gun either.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more that I can go
through.
Well,
Jamel, you looked through, I mean, you covered it extensively. What was like the most striking thing you saw in the grand jury documents, if you had to pick up one or two?
I mean, I've been focused a lot on Wilson's story, and what's striking to me is how it changes in between its first recording and then its later actual testimony to the grand jury.
Explain how it changed.
I mean, it goes, some of the basic facts are about the same, but what changes is sort of Wilson's apparent state of mind. Like in his initial story to investigators, which we actually don't know if that's the first one, we just don't. That's the first one that was recorded.
Yeah.
His story is, you know, X happened, Y happened, Z happened. I responded A, I responded B, I responded C. Not very much emotion. It didn't seem like he was freaked out by what happened, just sort of like, this is what happened.
Yeah.
And the story he tells to the grand jury, as we all know, all of a sudden this, you know, this terrible but sort of like straightforward event becomes this drama in which Wilson, Officer Friendly, is going down the street, and he is accosted by Michael Brown, Hulk Hogan, a demon-like figure, and he's terrified, he's afraid, and all of these other things. And that, to me, I mean, you know, maybe that doesn't mean anything. Maybe that's just a, you know, a plain case of trying to gussy it up for a crowd of people, essentially. But that, to me, is just, like, super revealing about what, at the very least, what Wilson in...
You're building a story to fit a narrative.
Right, right.
One thing that struck me is just in the midst of... I mean, I've interviewed many cops. I mean, I covered the police for a decade at City Paper. And the one thing... And I've also had interactions with the police as just a civilian. And the one thing that I noticed about Wilson's testimony is that he never cops to one thing that I think is sort of a natural thing, is anger. Here he is describing a teenager manhandling him, grabbing at his gun, and he never says, you know, he never expresses really much in the way of that he was pissed off that this was happening. And I just felt like his response is, well, I went through my use of force protocol, and I first thought of all the things on my belt. I went through the flashlight, where is my flashlight? And this is all during the course of this interaction in the car. It seems so clinical to the point of that it was rehearsed. Like, it didn't seem like, you know, it really pissed me off that this kid was giving me attitude, and I cussed him out, and then I grabbed at him, he grabbed at me. It didn't seem...
So there's nothing natural to it.
No.
Everybody here, raise your hand if you believe that this is what happened. Hey, fellas, could you get up on the sidewalk? And then let's pretend that Michael Brown cursed him out.
Says fuck.
Or no, he hadn't cursed him out yet, but the other guy keeps walking. And his response is, yeah, but hey, what about the sidewalk guys? All right. Now, is anybody here? Just raise your hand if you believe that.
My father used to have an expression, too much college.
Too much college?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That means that if you look at a situation, you over-intellectualize it, and you forget the reality, the practicality of the situation. What really happened here? Guys jaywalking? And so there's a confrontation that emerges out of that. It wasn't a conversation where a guy said, hey, would you please do anything or not? So it was probably more like, hey, get the fuck out of the street.
Yeah.
Right. Which is actually what the survivor had to say, right?
So there's this immediate tension that grows. And you got a kid here who is not a victim. You don't have a kid who's locked up for beating people up, this violent history. So you have this kid here, and a confrontation happens. Now, that's one point. But for me, to your question, I'm stuck on stupid, on the charge. You know, if you listen to or read what happens here, this is a kid who was shot, number one. Anybody on this table been shot?
In the past couple years.
Or stabbed? Okay, so he's not only shot, he's injured, and he's bleeding.
Yeah.
Okay, what's happening in this kid's mind? Any kid in the United States, he's running from the cops because He's been shot. He's got a problem. Cop's aggressive. He's got a problem. As a kid as aggressive as the cops, I'm just saying to you, I doubt it. Put that aside. At the point that the guy is running, big kid, he stops. He says, look, I'm in trouble. Yeah. If he, and when, and we know he stopped, and we know he turned around. And the testimony is disputed here as to what happened and different dynamics. But I could tell you one thing, and I've tried police cases. I've been in that courtroom where somebody was killed by a police officer.
Yeah.
Guy who's been shot doesn't put his hand in his belt when there is no gun, ball up his fist, and then kamikaze like run to a police officer.
What if he puts it in his belt because he's been shot around his waist? I mean, that seemed like to me, or unless I'm missing something.
Except that he wasn't. Question is, okay, so you've got a testimony is clear from this officer, if you're just talking about Wilson.
Sure. Right?
From the very moment Brown turns around, right hand goes in pants, left hand is balled up in a fist, and it remains that way until Michael Brown is face down, dead on the ground. I can tell you because I've been through in great detail. Crystal clear, never changes. And the reason the hand's in the waistband, why it's important, is because furtive gesture may be reaching for a weapon, which is why he's laser-like honed in on there. Right?
He says so. In
well,
the
so there's many questions as about subsidiary questions, but let's look at where the gunshot wounds were. All right, you got a gunshot wound. You got two of them that go through the
forearm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got one that goes through the bicep. All right. Now, just saying. If you got your hand on your pants, and let's pretend somehow one goes through here, well, there weren't any entrance wounds on the lower abdomen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, what's that consistent with? Right?
Yeah.
Gunshot wounds.
It's just, you're saying it's consistent with raising your hands.
Yeah. You're raising your hands. Sure. You see somebody shoot. You're putting your hands in this way. The gunshot wounds are through and through. Here and here.
Well, let's get to this, because I think what this illuminates is, or what the problem essentially was, and to play devil's advocate here, was that you had witnesses who were either sort of modifying their original testimony, and maybe rightfully so, or you had conflicting accounts that, you know, whether his hands were up in a defensive posture.
That happens every day.
So, yeah, can you explain why this was, you know, it seems like this is a natural thing. You have a fog of war, so to speak.
You're including Wilson in that, right?
Yes, I'm including Wilson in this.
Yes.
So you have a bunch of different stuff presented to this grand jury, but is that really that big a holdup?
Well, you know, I had a problem with that because I would like to know who talked to the witnesses when prior to their testimony. Because, and to what extent was their testimony massaged? Are you sure that you saw that? Well, I'm not so sure. Are you exactly sure? Well, maybe it wasn't where I thought it was, you see, because you don't control the witnesses. And so and there's no way to corroborate independently what the witnesses said before the prosecutors got to them. And for me, it was you asked about reaction. It was almost like a Broadway play to me. It could have been like a Grisham novel, the way it was set up. And I think there was not only a level of coziness, but my gut is that there was a level of collaboration.
Yeah,
to protect Wilson.
You know, I'm willing to say that the prosecutors were, or McCullough was kind of working to defend Wilson. I mean, if you look at the full sequence of events that even led up to the grand jury, you have, before Ferguson police even releasing Wilson's name, they release a video of an unrelated incident at the convenience store.
Yeah.
You have this very unusual grand jury in which it's sort of treated as quasi-trial, which I think when it happened, I was like, I'm not really sure what's happening. But now that we're a week removed, I think it's very clear why that was done. It gives the appearance of a trial having happened, of an adversarial trial having happened, despite that not happening at all.
It's almost like it was a PR stunt.
Right.
You had found in the testimony that even early on in the investigation, when he's being interviewed by like the sergeant or supervisor, the sergeant doesn't want to interview him. He refers to, what did he say? He said,
that's what I say. It starts from the beginning. Let me go back before I get to that,
sure,
to what happened on the scene. Because I think one of your questions you started into it is what surprised you about what you saw in the grand jury thing. I think, frankly, the biggest surprise to me is that they didn't even really try on the scene. In other words, I have never seen a case myself, maybe you have, Don, I don't know, but I have never seen a case where police shooting occurs, the supervisory folks arrive on the scene, particularly now that the guy's dead, and they then don't take the officer's gun and secure it, because that's major evidence. They don't keep the officer at the scene. They, in fact, lend him their vehicle to leave the scene. They don't tape anything at the scene. They don't photograph anything at the scene, any kind of injuries or not, or blood or not. And now he's off on his own. And then what happens between then and whenever somebody talks to him? Well, according to the officer, he goes back and he decides he's going to wash off the evidence.
Package his own
gun. Right? Wash off the evidence. If there was evidence, of course, the sergeant says there was no blood on him. He's very specific about that on the scene. So where the blood came from, who knows if it was there or not? Yeah. We won't know.
Yeah, so add to that, just in addition to the treatment of Wilson at the scene, is a treatment of police to people who had gathered at the scene, which instead of, you know, you immediately have police arrive in force with weapons and dogs to keep crowds back. When there are no major crowds, there is no threat to anyone, there are just curious neighbors. And that to me says so much about the mindset of police in Ferguson, that their response was, we have to contain this community. Yeah.
You don't have to go to Ferguson for that to happen, though. You know, right here in D.C., there's a different way that police view people between Northwest Washington and Southeast Washington. And this stigma and dynamic and this notion that there's devalued black life exists right here and in most cities in the poorest parts of the city. They don't view people as human beings. The color of the skin matters. The class level matters. I had one case where a man was drunk in Southeast, and he was stumbling along, and a cop was telling him to move, and the cop just knocked him out, just hit the man without any provocation whatsoever. Mm. You know, so you see that it really, the best thing that could happen out of this stuff is that there are these cameras, that there is this technology, but then we have to make that technology mean something, don't we?
Let's get to that. I mean, this actually is a really good segue into the Garner issue, where cameras were on. I mean, they were there filming. The cops knew that the camera, it was a cell phone camera, it wasn't a police camera, but it was there filming, and it still happened. Now, I know there's a dual point to having cameras. One is to monitor what happens, to make sure that there's, you know, clear evidence for any possible prosecution, but also as a deterrent, so police know that they can't, you know, their wildest impulses that they rein them in. But, you know, in this case, it just didn't seem to work.
It should help the police officers make their case, too. Hey, yeah, well, if I got video of whatever you did.
And that's my point, Doug.
That makes our job
easy. My point, Doug. So why didn't it work in Staten Island? I guess it's not foolproof. I'm going to grant you that, but I mean.
Well, I think I answered that question earlier. Was there a prosecutor that wanted an indictment?
But I also feel like there are mm-hmm. juries, but there are juries or grand juries that are very hesitant culturally to indict, to believe that an officer would kill somebody on purpose.
Well, especially if I guess I don't want to say too naive, but people like us who have seen grand juries and know how it works, and I have testified before them and whatnot. Grand jurors are called in to serve, and they do what the prosecutor gives them the lead to do. Sure. All right, that's the person. Those are the people they're dealing with.
In New York, though, doesn't that video footage defy that? Though, I mean, here's a man who is paying for his life, and the arm choke is around his neck. I mean, my problem is that I'm really deeply concerned about what message that is sending throughout this country. you know, particularly when it comes, you know, I was talking to my nephew before I left to come here, and these young people are like, what does it take? You know, they are fair
My first
game.
Question, that's my first question, what does it take? Here you have a guy, he's choking to death, he's caught on camera, 5 times says, I can't breathe. There is a law in New York City that prohibits police officers from instituting choke calls.
I don't think the police valued his life. I don't think culturally they value his life. I don't think they value.
Okay, that's fine, and we can go down that tangent. But again, if the solution or a partial solution is put cameras on these police officers or videotape what they did, doesn't this instance with Garner just?
So I happen not to think that putting cameras on police will directly solve anything. I mean, I don't, you know, in the case of Garner. It's a situation where, yeah, the police just didn't value his life. And so, you know, I think if you are the kind of person who is willing to use that kind of force against someone, you can figure out how to explain it away. Like, it's not too difficult.
They claimed he was resisting arrest.
Right. I think the value of cameras is exactly what's happening right now, that, like, the broader public can see what's happening. Mm-hmm. And you no longer have to take the police officer's word for it. Mm-hmm. And I think the sort of the differential nature of outrage with, say, Ferguson versus Eric Garner, where Ferguson, it's, like, very divided and very partisan, and Eric Garner, everyone more or less is like, this is some bullshit.
Yeah. I don't know if everyone is saying that. A lot of people maybe.
I wonder about people in Staten Island.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
They didn't say it.
No.
You know.
Yeah.
No.
I guess my hope is that.
No, but what you were talking about is how when we came into this room, and keep in mind, we're talking about, this has just happened an hour ago, that the political reaction to it, the ideological reaction to it, it's, you know, cross-partisan. Whereas with Michael Brown, it was almost like within, you know, minutes there was a partisan breakdown in how we were perceiving what had happened with the non-indictment. With Garner, you have conservative sides being like, this is complete horseshit.
And I think the value of that is...
You think that's camera-related?
I think it's camera-related. I think that people can see what's happening and they can react accordingly.
But this isn't the first police brutality case caught on camera. Ronnie King case, there were still those officers said, oh, that video, they just as Wilson knew what to say in his testimony, the officers know what to say, know the defenses against the videotapes. In the Ronnie King case, they said, oh, it's taken out of context, or you didn't get the whole thing because you can't hear what's going on. In that case, I think they claimed he was resisting arrest. And the same thing with Gardner. I mean, they could say that's their defense. And the problem is that people believe it. I mean,
you know, Jason, but you hit the nail on the head, though, because there's, in my mind...
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's the first time anyone has ever said that.
There's a cultural civil war kind of going on. I mean, there is, and it's a pretty deep thing in part. You know, you can't just say, well, it's not connected, even if it's minimally, to Obama. You know, I mean, there's some level of resentment there. And then the black male stereotype is vicious in terms of how people are perceiving black youth. You know, so whether it's in the incarceration level, because that same black kid, if he's before that same grand jury, he's indicted.
Can I just say something about his various versions? Because
Wilson's.
This is good enough time for that.
Yeah. There's no end time.
You start off on the scene, okay, with the statements that aren't recorded. But one of the things that, of course, the sergeant remembers very, very clearly is that when he got on the scene, Wilson is sitting in his car. And he went up and asked him what happened. Wilson said, I had to shoot him and whatever, got out of the car, started chasing him. Then he turned around after a while, his hands went up and he said, something to the extent of, you're too much of a pussy to shoot me. All right? Now, the sergeant is very, very clear on that. This is under oath.
It's not what people naturally say.
This is under oath.
But the
point is, which one of Wilson's versions do you believe? Because in every version, Wilson's telling the grand jury and everybody else that you're too much of a pussy started in the car when he said, I'm going to shoot you, and he pulled the gun out. But you read the sergeant's testimony, he is very, very clear. This happened when you were out after the guy ran, after he'd been shot, and when he turns around, says you're too much of a pussy. Now, they try to maybe he'll let him weasel out of it, but it doesn't happen. But in the descriptions of So
was
Brown.
The question asked, when did you state YouTube? But did you state it at the car?
But that's the problem. There's never.
They never asked that question. Yeah,
well, no, hell no. And obviously, that goes to sort of the.
Yeah, but you know, go get to it, Jamal.
And also, there's also this, just the science of just matching the forensic evidence in the car and on Brown with the incident, whether whatever happened in the car. It doesn't seem like it's a perfect match.
Well, I want to get back. Go ahead. I'll just
say real quick. If there were like video in this case, I don't think it changed the outcome. I think what would matter is it would change the public perception. And I think, you can have, same with Eric Garner, may not change the actual outcome of the grand jury. But, you know, if 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times a year this happens and we have video and we have protests and we have outrage. I'm saying if with like the video, like with the,
It is happening.
Well, let's talk. I want to.
But like, I think that changes.
Talking about the body cameras,
that,
I think.
That
right?
Changes the way the politics around this happens.
It seems like there's a pattern that's followed after all these things, which is an instance happens, and then suddenly selective information gets put out to the public to demonize the victim. And with Tamir Rice's case, what ended up happening was this atrocious article in a local Ohio newspaper. Basically looking at the arrest history of his dad as if that had any irrelevance to what this 12-year-old kid was or who he was.
Like that bottle of liquor that was on the table. And I said that was...
Yeah, where is it?
Do you want more?
Away.
There you go.
I said it was...
Yeah, you got
him. It was guilt by association.
Sorry, you're going to have my hands on there.
Yeah, yeah, no.
But it is, but it goes
stigmatized black people. You say, well, if this guy, it doesn't have to be black, it's just natural.
Yeah.
That it, once you impugn, even if it's vicarious, his mother was a prostitute. His mother, his sister is a drug addict.
It's just the way they are.
You know? Yeah. And so, and it goes back to this value civil war. You know, with somebody like a Giuliani, for example, making this obscene, insane comment that black, 50 million black people don't care about. Who do you think are the victims? Who do you think was upset when I got a call Sunday night that a young guy in Philadelphia was shot in his head? Yeah. Who do you think? Black people don't care? Black people probably care more than anybody.
Sure.
Because
this is empirically true.
Yeah.
And
Giuliani felt comfortable enough to say
this
that.
This is the problem.
Well, I want to get to Giuliani, but just to bring back my point, it's this smearing of my Jewish roots are coming out now, but the smearing of Tamir Rice's father seemed like the most atrocious attempt that I can recall. Like, usually when they try to, you know...
Giuliani's done that.
The relative?
He's got...
Usually they go after the victim himself and say, this guy was using drugs, or
I mean, it happened
he robbed a convenience store of cigarillos, or
I mean, the smearing of the father created a problem for Obama's daughters, too, didn't it?
I mean, I guess, but it just seems so absurd.
But also they're now trying to smear Michael Brown's stepfather. They're saying he now incited riots as a cover.
Yeah.
I think it's the playbook. I think that it's not just changing people's perceptions, but it's also, the police are very good. Their unions are very strong.
That's right.
And their playbook is they win every time. They're the Harlem Globetrotters.
But what's the
point?
They
don't lose.
The Rice case with the smearing of the victim.
The 12-year-old kid.
Yeah. So you've gone through this before. Can you give us like the worst things that you've experienced where maybe a client of yours or you've witnessed a case where, it was just an awful, PR attempt by the police or just to get, a bad image out there of your client?
I mean, that's routine.
Routine?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to always attempt to make the officer look like he was doing the right thing and the client, even if they're a graduate of college or, in that one case I had dental school, to make it look like the client or that person is the aggressor.
What happened with your case?
Police killed a man here in D.C. and he probably was as gentle as any 5-year-old. Same type of story that this man who didn't have a gun attacked the police officer upon an inquiry and confrontation. And the police shot him cold.
You both had done civil cases, and is that, at the end of the day, justice? that you've won on behalf of your client. You mentioned the FIT team as being a good tool, but as far as I know, every FIT team is exonerated.
The thing about it is,
before we start, what's a FIT team?
Force investigation team. It's not.
I'm doing it for the audience.
Yeah, that's good.
I've gone college.
Thank you.
You guys are funny.
I'm trying. It's the scotch, not me.
It's not the exoneration issue. It's the evidence,
the gathering of the evidence.
Information. And that's the same thing with, I think fundamentally in Ferguson, when you start having these taped interviews, et cetera, Ferguson's not over.
Yeah.
Ferguson is not over. And what the civil cases are very, very, very difficult. It's not justice because most of these people don't have the resources. Then the private citizens have to do what the American justice system should do. That's an onerous task for lawyers like this great lawyer here to have to do because he has to finance it out of his pocket. He has to finance the American justice system.
I just want to get back to the civil trial. And, you know, I'm curious what it would actually look like, how long it will take, what the process is.
The civil trial in this case?
In both the Brown case and perhaps the Garner case. The word is breaking right now that DOJ is going to investigate the Garner trial. I don't know how they're going
to
do it.
Depends on the lawyers and what they want to wait and do, but the civil trials can take 18 months to 3 years. Depends on the jurisdiction, the evidence, the process, and the crowded.
What kind of punishment can they?
It's not a punishment issue.
It's monetary.
No, I'm saying what kind of money
compensation?
Compensation.
Well, it depends.
I'm not talking about
You can get compensatory damages, and you can get punitive damages, and you can get economic damages. He's a wrongful death expert, and it depends on the wrongful death laws in the different states and to what a person could recover.
And you can also get many of these cases when you prevail, the attorney fees paid for, which is different from most cases. But what does the case look like and everything else? I just have to tell you, for me, once I discover everything that nobody else bothered to bring out, we're not usually going to trial. By the time we get close to trial,
they don't want the
gig's up because we've now brought in. They didn't do the blood spatter, ballistics, crime scene, everything. Maybe the cops didn't. But in my case, just because it happened where my guy lived and his parents let me in, I bring my guy in and he does it. So we can establish, hey, guess what? The trajectory wasn't as you said. The guy was on the floor when you shot him and everything. So once you lay all that out there and you get it all and you put all the evidence in that you developed that nobody else heard about because they never prosecuted it and you never had a chance. So once you get through all that, in my experience, I have a very good prospect. When they know it's over, they don't want to go to trial.
How would you depose Darren Wilson? What would be some of the angles
you'd
take?
That is a good question. What would you say?
Finally.
one of the things I would do is I'd like to get his cell phone records from the point of the shooting to the hospitalization. Because I think that what happens in my experience is that people are not sophisticated. Just like that slap is potentially on the wrong side of the face. People are impulsive, et cetera. And I would bet you a dollar to a penny that there are text messages today and cell phone calls today between he and his superiors and others. That 4-hour period of time that Michael Brown's on that body, everything is going on. So you can get information.
Talking to somebody in the car on the way to the police station. Yeah.
You can get information and the like. That's one thing. But they're very interesting. But you could ask the question much more detailed in terms of the progression. So you called him over for the jaywalking. Where was he? What did he say? What was he doing? Et cetera. You can get much more graphic details. Huh. And then you can show the inconsistencies.
I mean, there's a gazillion inconsistencies. Not inconsistencies, there's a gazillion different versions.
Yeah, you get a chance to ask Darren Wilson.
Yeah,
what do you ask him?
I'd probably give him a chance. I'd start off nice and easy and sweet with him and give him a chance to keep letting this guy grow into a monster. Because, you know, he had that his first statement, he just had, he grabbed the guy's arm, right? And that's about all. Right, the very first statement he gave. Okay. And then later in the grand jury, when he grabbed the guy's arm, it's the only place he touched him, the arm was so strong, it was like Hulk Hogan, and he was a five-year-old. So I can sort of envision him being flown
away. But you also
away.
Have, you also would yeah. have the demonstration at the
right.
car.
Well, you're videotaping it.
I mean, where you're showing me how he came into the car while you're here with something between you and the next seat, and what that energy is like at that particular time. Where is your hand? Where is this hand? Where is his hand? Where is his other hand? And you can get that. That is not in this
let me go on to his imagery that I'd like him to build on, because it's like when you just sort of let the guy go. Because indeed, what happened then when the guy was, when he says, "Oh, I turned around," and either he did at that point say, "You're too much of a pussy, you suit me," or he said it earlier, or never at all, depending on which of the many versions you believe, he then was bulked up with demonic eyes to run through me. Right? In my mind, now I'm thinking of the Incredible Hulk.
Sure.
Remember that guy?
Yeah.
Right? The muscles are splitting the seams, and he's bulking up to run. And I'm guessing by the time you get to deposition, for all I know, the guy's going to be King Kong stepping on somebody and squishing him. And that's what I'm afraid of. So I let him go, and I go, and I go.
You let him bury his own grave.
Oh, no, I keep building on that stuff and keep...
But hold on, I want to ask the last member of our Star Legal team here, Jamel.
Wait,
if you, and you're not a lawyer yet. I know you're studying. If you could ask Darren Wilson one thing, what would it be?
I mean, I would take that approach, just asking very particular questions about every single stage of that interaction, because I believe that that was his testimony to the grand jury was completely coached, and I think that if you were to ask him a series of hyper-specific questions about every single motion in his testimony, eventually you're going to come to a point where just like he's.
I would focus on the waistband and the hand, because that seems to be the sort of the flourish that went too far, because he says he's focusing on the eyes, or they're menacing, they're demon, but then here he says, I was just looking at his hand the whole time. And this, to me, seems like, and from a distance of how many feet, like 150 feet?
150, yeah.
How demonic does somebody look?
We've had a 2-week period now where, you know, 3 incredible instances of police shooting. We're going to have protests, obviously, following this Garner and non-indictment. You know, and as a historical matter, I mean, where does this stand? Maybe it's too soon to judge, but it just seems like the wave of horrible news really, you know, is unprecedented in some respects.
Well, I don't think it's unprecedented.
Okay.
If you look at the pre-civil rights era, and if you look at the locuses for the organization of especially middle and upper middle class blacks and political activism, it's all around these kind of shootings. And in cities across the country, you have from the beginning of the 1900s until the middle of the, until roughly the beginning of the civil rights movement, when you have a broader set of issues.
And lynchings.
Other kinds of extrajudicial violence, police killings, are really the nucleus for black political activism in the first half of the 20th century. What this is a return to a very old script and a very old very old method of organizing in politics. The potential difference is that in, say, 1950s New Orleans, when cops were just like shooting people, like nothing, concern was pretty much just within the black community. Now there are bi and interracial coalitions around these things, and that's a difference I would not underestimate.
As Chris Rock said, white people have gone.
White people. There's a larger proportion of better white people these days, and that and that matters.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I was. You sort of stole it. I'm glad you did, because you articulated better than I did. But I was going to. I was going to give an answer. Look, you got to divide the historical perspective for me. Before the pre-Martin Luther King death kind of era to the recent stuff, because that other stuff doesn't compare.
Okay, let's do post Civil Rights Act era, that type of, you know, past 30 years type of thing. Is this one of the craziest sequence of events you've seen?
I think it's too early to tell. I hope that it leads to some change. I'm skeptical that it will. I never believed I was going to see my African-American president elected in my lifetime, who I, you know, helped and worked to do. I never believed that would happen until it did. I don't believe there's going to be major changes in the way the sort of police the issues occur and shootings. And look, no question, African-Americans suffer more than whites from this, but it also happens to whites as well, because I've represented whites shot and killed by cops, right? So it's the whole thing. I'm not convinced at all that it's going to change, but I'm hopeful that it will.
Sure. I don't think anything's going to change. I think we'll move on, and I think a lot of the stuff that sort of come up are sort of deep-seated racism and perceptions. I think some of this has to do with Obama, the hatred towards Obama. I think I was just stunned to see the sort of hatred of the the Rams players for holding their hands.
Oh my God.
I mean, the vitriol that was getting was towards them was unreal. Yeah.
And that's the thing. You're surprised. I'm not.
Well, I'm easily shocked.
It goes back to my thesis about the value of black life, but it's probably a bunch of people who are over 40, again, over 45. I have a lot of hope for younger people, because I think that they're thinking. I think that they're learning. I'm not ready to be pessimistic. I think that it's a tough call, some tough things going on, but that's how God works, you know? I mean, they didn't believe this Ferguson thing. And people still say, well, this Michael Brown's a bad guy. And now I want to see what they say about Gardner. Yeah. Because Gardner is proof certain that there is an issue. And so people have some level of responsibility. And I go back to how they perceive the democracy. You know what I mean? And I also go back to the dangers inherent in the change and the acceptance of things like this in the country. I just think that people are fragile, but that's what ultimately makes us different, huh?
Thank you for listening to Drinking and Talking. Hope you come back and join us for future episodes. And please, share this with a friend. Special thanks go out to the production team, Christine Canetta, Ibrahim Balki, Chris Gentleviso, Adriana Rosaro, Brad Shannon, and of course, Jason Lincolns. If you got any suggestions about topics or story ideas that we should pursue, or if you just want to suggest what type of booze we should be drinking, feel free to email us at drinkandtalk@huffingtonpost.com.